Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, discussion, science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and also live on the phone. So I'll be giving out those numbers in just a few minutes. But before I do so, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Today, we have some stories about superbugs and also what not to do right after a heart attack, or maybe even for a long time after a heart attack. Now, we have a report coming out of Denmark. Denmark has some really wonderful big data, largely because they have a national healthcare system that pays for drugs, and they've been keeping notes on that national healthcare system since World War II. So they can go back and ask questions like, what happens when you take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories? That would be your ibuprofen, your naproxen. And what happens when you take those after a heart attack? Because there's been reports that maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe there are problems. And the Danes decided to take a look at it. This was a recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And to cut to the chase, you really don't want to take ibuprofen, Motrin, Advil, Aleve, etc. after a heart attack ever again, because there is a fairly strong correlation between another heart attack. A recurrent heart attack was about 40% more likely in people who had used non-steroidal. It seems to interfere with the effects of the aspirin that people take, and it also interferes with Plavix, and it interferes with warfarin, which is surprising. We wouldn't have expected it to interfere with the vitamin K antagonist warfarin, but indeed, statistically at least, there were increased heart attacks in that group. There were, of course, also increased GI bleeds, but then we all knew that that is a fairly common side effect of non-steroidals. A lot of intriguing data came out from this study, including that when you start, this was counterintuitive to me as a doctor, which was that there was a threefold increase in GI bleeds within the first 3 days of initiating NSAID therapy. So we think that these drugs work, cause problems in the gut by interfering with protective mucus and also increasing the probability that the blood, that the platelets won't be able to staunch a small bleed that gets rolling. So those effects are late effects. And this early effect within the first 3 days, a threefold increase in GI bleeds, was totally unexpected and came out of this big data analysis. So if you must take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, take them with food, take them for brief periods of time. The longer you take them, the more likely you are to have a GI bleed. And the last time I checked the stats on this, we hospitalize 40,000 people a year in the United States for complications of non-steroidal use. Now, I promised you some stuff on superbugs, and I'm going to start with an ancient eye potion that proved extremely effective against some of those MRSA superbugs that we're dealing with. This came out of an old book called Bald's Leech Book, written in Old English. It's completely illegible. They had to get an Anglo-Saxon expert from the School of English in Nottingham University in the UK to translate it. The recipe that came out of this book was leeks, garlic, wine, and bull gall. That would be basically bile from a bull. You put it in a copper pot and you ferment it for exactly 9 days. And what you get is a very strong antibiotic that kills MRSA very effectively. Applied to skin lesions on mice, it cleared up the MRSA killed about 90% of the bacteria and allowed the immune systems of the mice to do the rest. Interestingly enough, the fermentation process also sterilized the mixture. This was a recipe for something to be used for sty, and now they have to figure out what the active ingredients are, but there may be a new antibiotic in store for us in this very, very old fermented mixture of onions and wine. Now, also a superbug story about cigarette smoke. Now, one more reason not to smoke cigarettes is that it makes MRSA bacteria more resistant to being killed by the immune system. The researchers are at the UC San Diego and the VA department down there in San Diego, and they were studying MRSA and looking in test tubes. And what they found was that when the MRSA had been previously exposed to a cigarette smoke extract that was about the same concentration of cotinine and the other chemicals in cigarette smoke that would be present in the bloodstream of an active smoker, the macrophages, and these macrophages had not been exposed to the cigarette smoke, had a harder time in killing the bacteria. The smoke-exposed MRSA bacteria were more resistant to being killed by peroxidase, a reactive oxygen species, which is what is the main thing that our immune system amoebas, these macrophages, use to kill. And the effect was dose-dependent. In other words, the more smoke extract that the bacteria were exposed to, the more resistant they were. The MRSA treated with the cigarette smoke extract were also more efficient at infecting human cells. They were better at sticking to and invading. And they survived better in a mouse model and caused pneumonia with a higher mortality rate. Turns out that the cigarette smoke strengthens the MRSA bacteria by altering their cell walls in a way that they're better able to repel the natural antimicrobial peptides and other charged particles. So another reason, obviously, if it's true for MRSA, it's probably true for other forms of bacteria. So quite an interesting little tale there. Last week, I had mentioned on the program that PANDAS is a disorder that is associated with mitochondrial SNPs. John in Santa Cruz sent me back an email saying, you know, you need to amplify on PANDAS because it actually isn't necessarily associated with mitochondria. So I did follow up on that, John, and you sent me a link to the NIH website, which talks about this at length. And PANDAS is a acronym for a condition that is a sudden onset of ADD, and there's often tics. It's an acronym for pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections. That's one of the most bizarre acronyms I've ever heard, but which is why I couldn't remember what it stood for. But anyway, it is known to be an autoimmune disorder. There are cytokines that are elevated. There's causes inflammation in particular parts of the brain and manifests itself with sudden onset of obsessive compulsive disorder in children. It's often also associated with tics, and it can be triggered by other infections. In fact, it's probably similar in some ways to chronic fatigue syndrome, which is also a chronic upregulation of the immune system, not strictly speaking an autoimmune disease, but simply where the inflammation diffuse and widespread, and the products of inflammation, the cytokines, make the person feel tired and sick. In the case of PANDAS, there really is an autoimmune attack, and it's similar to rheumatic fever and the kidney disease that we sometimes see after a strep infection. strep bacteria hide by imitating our surface antigens. And in some people, the antibodies they make to strep attack their own body surfaces. It could be the heart valves, and which is why strep throat is often treated with antibiotics. It can be the kidneys, and strep skin infections will often, for some reason, have a greater predisposition for causing a kidney inflammation called glomerulonephritis. But there's also something called Sydenham chorea, which is where these anti-strep antibodies attack the brain and cause a movement disorder. And of course, we now have this OCD PANDAS. Now, there is, however, a lot of research going on about the genetics of this. And in fact, I was right about the mitochondrial SNP. There is a risk gene associated with PANDAS. And if you have a TRAP1 SNP or variation in your DNA, you are more likely to develop these the PANDAS syndrome. So it's not a mitochondrial disorder, but it's associated with mitochondrial dysfunction, and there is a mitochondrial gene that is there. So I was only partially wrong. Let's go to Mark in Monterey. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the program. Hi, how are you?
Good. You're wonderful. You're one of the main reasons I support this station.
Oh, well, thank you. Hear that, Terry?
Yeah. And I wanted to mention that I've had type 1 diabetes for many years, and I have trouble with blood pressure, and I've tried all the 5 classes of blood pressure medications and studied them. But unfortunately, I get all the side effects. I either get the swelling or this or that. But one thing I have noticed lately is that if in the morning, if I take a small amount of alprazolam, 0.25 sedative, mm-hmm. I get good blood pressures. I don't understand why, but my thinking in taking it, because I had had some, is that, you know, it's the relaxing.
Yes.
I'm thinking about relaxing blood vessels. And I take it, the only other blood pressure medicine I take is an alpha blocker because I don't get any negative side effects.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think of this combo?
Well, for one thing, the key was in, like, your first sentence. You have a type 1 diabetes.
Right.
And this, by definition, almost anyone who's got type 1 diabetes, if they live long enough, more than 10 years with their disease, they will develop damage to the endothelium, which is the lining of the blood vessel wall.
It's
a very unique kind of damage, actually. The blood vessel walls accumulate a material that's essentially a kind of glucose goo. And this is a glycosylated protein.
Right.
Hemoglobin A1C is a glycosylated protein,
right.
And we use that to measure diabetic control. So many people are familiar with that. But all of the proteins in the body of a type 1 diabetic in particular can become glycosylated, and these blood these damaged blood vessels that accumulate this material do not produce nitric oxide in response to adrenaline. And so there's your piece. Your adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidney, put out adrenaline.
Yes.
This should cause a spasm and then an immediate relaxation and dilation of the blood vessels. And in your case, the endothelial cells are sluggish and they don't produce that nitric oxide. Now, there are some natural things you can do,
I want to
go to your question. Your question is, does it make sense? So you're taking an alpha blocker because alpha blockers block the alpha epinephrine receptors, and those are the ones that are in the blood vessel walls.
Right.
So you don't let the adrenaline get to the blood vessel wall, and that makes very much sense. Now, in the case of your Xanax, you're taking a teeny tiny dose of alprazolam or Xanax. That's calming down the brain, and therefore the brain is not sending as big a wake up signal to the adrenals, and the adrenals are not sending out a burst of adrenaline. And therefore, you don't have your out the blocker doesn't have anything to block at that exact moment.
Because I've done everything else. I'm pretty much a vegan. I read every label. Very, very low salt, if any at all. I do everything. And
do you meditate or do other relaxation work?
The meditation I try, but it's just difficult to make a practice of.
Mm-hmm.
But
for you, I think you really want to work at that, and you might try biofeedback. There's some good. A lot of people are very much in their head, and you sound like a person. The way you were saying in agreeing with me, you were right in there as I was saying these things. That makes me think that you're a high clock speed person and intense. And
yes.
And so
Mediterranean background, you know.
Yeah. Do you talk with your hands?
Spanish, you know, very. You know, emotional people.
Well, that's, you know, there literally are epigenetics. And so some of these stereotypes that we have probably are hardwired into our genes, or at least, if not hardwired, at least firmwired into our DNA. But you can modulate that because you can modulate your brain functioning. And brainwave biofeedback, either hooking up to an EEG device, and those kits are available fairly cheaply. And there's also HeartMath, which is a company up in Boulder Creek. They have some products that have pretty good science behind them. I mean, you can hook people up once they get practice with these techniques that the HeartMath people sell. You can actually hook them up to a galvanic skin response monitor or other physiologic devices and watch that they can, in fact, modulate their physiology. So this is a skill. You can acquire it. There are technological ways of doing the reinforcement part that might work for you rather than sitting there and doing a mantra. You may not have the patience for meditation, but biofeedback may work for you. So I would head off in that direction. I also want you to get some celery seed and start sprinkling celery seed on your food and eating beets, because you could do beet juice, for example, in your smoothie or something like that. The nitrites, it's nitrates, but anyway, it's nitrogen products in beets. Are really good because they help they help you drop your blood pressure.
And it does work. I listened to you a few weeks ago, and you talked about the beet powder extract, root extract, and I did find it at a vitamin shop, if I'm allowed to say that. And it does work. I came down 20 points.
Amazing, huh?
And so I take that in the morning, and it also provides a good fiber, you know, for my intestinal. And again, so I really look for all the alternative ways to get that blood pressure down. And it does work, one capsule, and then I intensify it with the prazolam, so I'm like a defense, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, now, the downside of a prazolam, and you're using very small doses, so you may not get receptor downregulation in the brain, but the body fights back. And whenever you use a ligand, something that's a ligand, which means it'll fit into the receptor, when you use a ligand, there is the potential for the body to say, oh, I've got my receptor being filled. I guess I don't need to make as many receptors. That's called receptor downregulation. And the problem with that is once you downregulate the receptors, if you take away the extra ligand, if you stop taking the Xanax or run out, or it's unavailable to you for whatever reason, you might experience more agitation, which, given your blood pressure issues, should that ever happen, I would encourage you to monitor carefully and be, you know, right there with your doctor. You shouldn't ever take more alpha blocker without clearing it with your physician.
Right.
But that might be something you need to do should you ever be in a situation where you don't have Xanax available. And you just won't know. But so if you don't take it, you'll have to monitor.
Yeah, and I do use a manual blood pressure cuff because, unfortunately, the automated ones, I compared it with my doctor's office, who only uses a manual cuff. And it was 20 points off.
Yeah, the manual ones. It depends on the person. It depends on the size of their arm. It depends upon the stiffness of their blood vessel wall, which unfortunately in you is pretty darn stiff.
Got it.
And that, again, is part of the downside of type 1 diabetes right. is you've got a kind of Benjamin, you know, the Benjamin Button effect, or the progeria is that disease that sometimes you'll see children who look like old people and their cells are aging very quickly. I believe it's a telomere disease, actually, if I remember correctly. But anyway, that is happening at the microscopic level in the body of a diabetic. And so these, you will have to live around this, but you know, with the technologies that we have at our disposal, rather than dying in your early 30s of this disease, which was typical before we had treatment, you now have the potential for a normal or near normal lifespan.
Right. Takes work.
You probably won't get to be the world's oldest person, though. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you again. And again, you're one of the reasons I support this station. And so, many thanks.
Well, thank you for the call and for sharing your very interesting issues and observations. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, anyone who's a regular listener to this program knows I love stem cells. And I'm also, you know, the devil's in the details on stem cells. So one of the problems we've had with treatments, looking for treatments for Parkinson's with stem cells, is the annoying tendency that stem cells injected into the brains of mouse models or rat models for Parkinson's have to form tumors. So darn it, it fixes the Parkinson's, but the animals die of brain tumors, so that isn't a plus. Researchers recently came up with a technique, and this is a group down in Brazil, the Dor Institute for Research in Education and the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. And what they have done is played around with a drug that's normally used for cancer chemotherapy. It's called mitomycin C. And they pre-treated the stem cells with mitomycin C and then injected them. They had three groups. Each was injected with 50,000 stem cells. Animals who got just the regular stem cells showed improvement in their Parkinson's, but they all died 7 weeks later because of intracranial tumors. The animals who received the pre-treated stem cells, again, 50,000 stem cells pre-treated with mitomycin C, at 12 weeks transplant had no tumors, and four of these mice were allowed to keep living instead of being chopped up to look for tumors. And at 15 months, they were still walking around being little non-Parkinson's mice after having been set up to develop the Parkinson's disease and having already developed it. So this is very, very good news, chiefly because this drug is already approved for use in humans. The mitomycin C is already okay to use in humans. So that means a whole lot of FDA approval steps can be leapt over and we can move to the next stage, which would be using this in clinical, first in animal trials probably, and then clinical, and then in higher primates, and then moving into maybe using it in humans. This may turn out to be a real game changer, so stay tuned for more, but I can't wait to see how this one turns out. I want to turn to an email from Mike in Ohio. Dear Dr. Dawn, I'm a listener since 2012. I have an operation coming in early April for cancer in my peritoneal cavity. The tumors have fastened themselves to my omentum and show up on the PET scan around there. So I'm going to the James Center at OSU for a HIPAC procedure. HIPAC, by the way, folks, is hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy. You basically heat up the chemotherapy, typically cisplatin, to 103 degrees Fahrenheit, and then you pump it into the abdominal cavity. And meanwhile, the person is lying on a cooling blanket so they don't get hyperthermia. And the doctors literally rock you back and forth for a couple of hours to sort of shake the chemo drug into all possible areas of the abdomen. And the idea is that by heating it, you make the drug more effective. It increases blood flow to the area and seems to make the cancers more vulnerable to the effect of the chemo. I understand, and picking up on Mike's letter, I understand there's a good chance of recurrence of my cancer. The source was from the appendix. The omentum will be removed and I'll get the thermal bath. So what questions should I be asking the doctor? What's a good prep for that surgery with regard to supplements and post-surgery too? You wanted to know whether pec, and he says, I realize that you gave that information a few weeks ago, but I question whether pectin and some of the other supplements matter since my cancer is not sitting in an organ or on a blood vessel. Does zinc echinacea still apply to my kind of surgery since I'm getting a bath all around the fluid area? I'm concerned about the chemicals being placed in my body and what absorption might take place during treatment. Well, I think that in a situation like this, when our current technology is being what it is, we are essentially trying to poison you enough to kill your cancer cells, but not enough to kill you. And so recovering from any kind of poisoning is essentially a function of the liver. Now, in this case, the spread of the cancer is technically local in the sense that it came out from your appendix, which was removed and had cancer in it. And that cancer spilled or spread locally through the abdomen, but has not gone through, at least at this point, so far as we can tell, through the bloodstream. But you will be getting that chemotherapy. There will be some absorption of the drug into the bloodstream. And so that piece of it is what I'm referring to here with respect to the liver. So the types of liver support entities that you want to do before a chemotherapy are basically things that upregulate your detoxification SNPs. Earlier, we talked about leeks and garlic being used, being fermented to make an antibacterial. But one of the wonderful things that are in the fruits and vegetables, but particularly the crucifers, that's your sulfur-containing, and your sulfur-containing, which is your leeks and your allicins. So leeks, onions, garlic, yes, lots of that. Also, lots of broccoli, cauliflower, kale, broccoli sprouts are probably the best and most palatable way to get large quantities of these things. And since the good stuff that comes in broccoli and the other crucifers needs to be fermented in your intestines, being sure that you're taking probiotics and eating fermented foods, fermented dairy, if you can tolerate it, is good. I'm a fan of yogurt, even in a cancer situation. I think you get benefit from those probiotics that outweighs any theoretical harm from the growth factors that are present in milk. I'm actually not sure whether those growth factors make it through the fermentation process into yogurt anyway. That would be an interesting literature search, wouldn't it? Anyway, go to my archives and look at detoxification in the interviews with Jeff Bland. They're up there in the archives under interviews. And those detoxification interviews give lots of specific advice about functional foods that help improve detoxification. The other thing I would say, Mike, is as soon as you are sure that you're not going to dehydrate, in other words, no nausea, vomiting, diarrhea going on, start doing sweats, either saunas or contrast showers, sweat lodges. But sweating is a great way to help your body get rid of toxins. The metal that you're going to get, the platinum that comes in with the cisplatinum, will accumulate in your body. So using something that helps you get rid of metals, typically what we're talking about would be N-acetylcysteine, which helps your body make glutathione. When you're trying to get rid of metals, you consume glutathione, which is a really important aspect of detoxification. Those would be all, you know, really important things for you to be doing. And yes, I still would use the citrus pectin. I recommend that for anybody who's going to be getting a cancer-related surgery. There is evidence that it helps any circulating cancer cells not stick. And that's what you want. You want them to leave your body. You do not want them to nestle up in a corner somewhere and come back 10 years later. The Bland Detox interview date is April 22nd, 2006. Thank you, Charlie. This one from Christy in Watsonville. I recently received a fecal test showing an H. pylori reading of greater than 8. Less than 0.9 is normal. I believed I had a fairly good diet with little red meat, plenty of fruits, veggies, grains, but was tested because I was having many of the expected symptoms. The Western remedy seems to be antibiotics. Would you start with this, as diet doesn't seem to have successfully controlled the symptoms? Thank you for your thoughts. Well, Christy, I'm wondering what your symptoms are and if they are the ulcer-type symptoms like GI distress, stomach pain, burning after eating, then you may have a condition called achlorhydria. Means low stomach acid. And when people have low stomach acid, it's easier for them to become infected with various bacteria and to develop a dysbiosis. And H. pylori, oddly enough, is a bacteria that likes stomach acid, and it will actually hook into your intestine. Your stomach is, of course, its favorite place to live, and it will turn on. It will secrete factors that actually cause your stomach acid secreting cells to secrete more acid. So it sends a false signal, if you will, to your own acid factory and cranks it up. Well, the problem with that is that it can lead to ulcers. But paradoxically, the originating problem may have been low stomach acid, even though the immediate problem is so much stomach acid that you're at risk for getting an ulcer. Historically, ulcers used to recur. We put it down to stress. We put people on a bland diet. When proton pump inhibitor drugs were invented, of course, they were initially invented for severe esophagitis and very rapidly became standard therapy for ulcers. But we also discovered that when you stopped the drug, the ulcers came back. A researcher whose name is escaping me right now proposed that maybe this bacterium, Helicobacter pylori, was the source of ulcers. And over about 20 years' time, that has become the established truth, is that you're taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, or you have H. pylori, or you have a tumor that is a gastrin hypersecreting tumor, and those are the reasons that people get stomach ulcers. Well, you know, the received wisdom is always not quite correct. But in this case, I do go to a brief course of antibiotics, usually about 2 weeks, with bismuth and a proton pump inhibitor for the treatment of H. pylori. What I'm also doing clinically myself is putting people on probiotics during and after the treatment, because I know that those antibiotics I'm giving are going to unbalance the gut flora, and I want to be sure I don't give them another problem. And there are a number of different antibiotic protocols. Given with the KISS principle, I generally use an agent called Biaxin, although people who have certain heart conditions shouldn't use Biaxin. That's something that if you've got a long QT syndrome, for example, an electrophysiological change that's benign except when you come in contact with certain pharmaceuticals, that's not a drug you should be taking. And there's certain drug interactions, things that aren't broken down well when you're taking Biaxin, because it's an inhibitor of those all important liver detoxification enzymes. But that being said, that's one of the drugs I use most frequently. Clarithromycin is the generic term for that. Subsequent to the treatment, I will put people on hydrochloric acid supplements for a while, and you can look up protocols for how to take betaine hydrochloride. It's widely available in health food stores, so I won't go into those here. And I'll often put people on DGI, which is deglycerized licorice. That is a demulcent. It's a soother and a coating of, and it sort of replaces or augments the protective mucus, which if it was working perfectly, you wouldn't have this problem. Other things, by the way, that I recently learned that disrupt protective mucus, news to me, but very important to keep reinforcing this, is the homogenizing agents that are used in lots and lots of food products. So it's extraordinarily important that you protect that stomach lining in the wake of a treatment for H. pylori. I hope you found that helpful. And sometimes you do need to actually go to the antibiotics. I will say that some of my natural medicine colleagues might attempt and have successfully treated H. pylori with oregano oil. It takes about 6 to 8 weeks, and I worry about patient compliance. And since I feel pretty confident that these antibiotics can be used safely for brief periods of time, I do use those. So I think that's probably a long answer to a short question, but hopefully we covered a lot of extra ground there that some of you will find useful, particularly the thing about the emulsifiers that I just mentioned in food products. There are a lot of them in processed food, and I think maybe we need to really rethink our processed foods. I did hear from my dear friend Jane, who runs an organic certification company or works for one. I'm not quite sure if she's the, I don't think she's quite at the CEO level, but anyway, knowing Jane, she's probably the power behind the throne if she's not sitting on it. Specifically though, with reference to emulsifiers or foods that are labeled certified organic on the label, if it's a processed food, have very little in the way of emulsifiers, and I would consider those to be definitely in the category of assumed, it's okay to assume that these are safe. Now, let's see, we had an off-air question. Did I ever hear of the vampire fungus Pythium olandrum that eats the offending fungus of infects fingernails? No, I did never hear of this, but I will definitely research the vampire fungus and bring it back to you. That sounds like a wonderful fight fire with fire treatment for toenail fungus. I'm wondering if the off-air caller who was inquiring has tried Vicks, which is supposedly a very good treatment for fingernail fungus. I'm quite fond of a chemical product called Nonyx, N-O-N-Y-X, that you paint on nails. That's an over-the-counter product, but it is a chemical that, you know, that's true. Urea, which is a natural compound, although it is somewhat toxic, it's still a nice natural compound, a byproduct of protein degradation. Urea paste applied at 20% to 40% to a fungal toenail will actually melt only the unhealthy part of the toenail. A little tidbit that came out of Russia in the late 1970s and was told to me by my then Kaiser doc when I was in college. So all sorts of lovely little trivia about toenail fungus. The numbers to call, 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. Go to our next email here. This from Martha in Santa Cruz. Estrogen in soy and dairy and estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Does the estrogen in cow's milk and soy milk react with estrogen receptors on breast cancer tumor cells? What's the risk of consuming these for survivors of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer? Is there any new research? What alternatives can you recommend? Rice milk has arsenic. The nut milks cause a lot of gas. I use a small amount of soy creamer in coffee, 1 cup per day, and about half a cup of soy milk in cereal about 3 times a week. I took Arimidex for 3 years and have been on Avista for 4 months. Can Avista protect me from soy phytoestrogens? Lots of questions there. So, and there's no single answer, actually, Martha, because context is really important here. So if a woman is producing any estrogen of her own, and that is to say she has functional ovaries, or she's producing a little bit, of course, in her adrenal glands, and if she's overweight, she's producing estrone in her body fat, and estrone can stimulate the estrogen receptor on breast cancer cells or on breast cells. So that is an issue. Estrone also can be broken down into a type of estrogen byproduct called 4-hydroxyestrone, which is actually capable of damaging DNA. And of course, none of us want to damage our DNA. The soy issue is interesting. And there's a lot of conflicting research, but the way I would try to explain it is that estrogen is a strong magnet, and it sticks to that receptor very, very strongly. Plant estrogens, like those like ginestin and other compounds that are found in soy, plant estrogens are weak magnets. And if a strong magnet were to come along, it might bounce off of the receptor if there was a weak magnet sitting on the receptor. So that would be good, because under some circumstances, the plant estrogens would actually mask the estrogen receptor. But the weak magnet does stimulate the receptor somewhat. And so you do get some stimulation. And a lot of the soy paranoia comes from in test tube research that showed that if you take breast cancer cells that are growing in a test tube, in vitro, this is called, and you put small extracts of these phytoestrogens from soy in the nutrient media, you do get faster growth of the cancers. Now, why that I say it's contextual is if you do this study and you put estrogen, human estrogen, and soy into the growth medium, and you compare that to no soy or estrogen and just estrogen, just the human estrogen, what you find is that the soy is in the middle. It blocks the influence of some of that estrogen. So it's a relatively good thing if you have estrogen on board to eat soy, and a relatively bad thing if you don't have estrogen on board, because then the weak stimulation effect is bad for you. Now, in terms of the practical difficulties, and by the way, good data. This is very solid data out of Japan, that if you consume soy as a female when you're going through puberty, you get a lifelong benefit in terms of lower breast cancer rates. So giving soy to middle school girls is an excellent idea because it tends to block some of the excess estrogen and apparently has a protective effect for their breasts for the rest of their life. Postmenopausally, there may be some small risk of soy stimulating an estrogen receptor. And we don't really know the answer in you, because we don't know if you've got any breast cancer cells left in your body hibernating somewhere that could potentially wake up and start growing a bit faster because of your soy consumption. The other risk for milk is that it contains, if it's not organic, bovine growth hormone. And even if it is organic, it does contain insulin-like growth factor number 1, which it's a growth factor. So it in vitro studies will stimulate the growth of cancer cells. So should you be drinking dairy when you've had cancer? You know, probably not. I would suggest coconut creamer as a substitute. There's coconut milk as well. And this does not contain any phytoestrogens that at least have been reported, in contradistinction to soy. So that would be a good substitute product for you that would allow you to have your cereal and your coffee. The arsenic issue in rice is actually real. I've had patients that I've had on cereal metal who I'm testing for heavy metals because of mercury or lead exposures in their occupation, and we're monitoring them. And when they have switched to a higher rice diet, which was done for a different indication, I did see arsenic levels bump up noticeably when I did my provoked metal tests. So you can get enough arsenic from rice to challenge your body's detoxification. And so you are right that that's an issue. Let's go now to Molly in Salinas. Hello, Molly, and welcome to the program.
Yes, ma'am. I had a question regarding the cause of collection of the water around heart.
Okay. Now, the collection of water around the heart is called, if we're talking about the thing I think we're talking about, it's called a pericardial effusion. And often these are caused by infections of some sort. Sometimes there are viral infections that will do it. There are some bacterial infections that will do it. We sometimes see this under other circumstances where the blood vessels have become leaky for some reason. Do you have this collection of fluid around your heart?
No, ma'am. It's a relative live across the, overseas.
Uh-huh.
I heard recently that she has this problem, and I just was wondering. I thought to go to the library, look at some reference book, but still I thought they mentioned it by name rather than, just explanation.
Right.
And,
so you want to you want to search on peri, P-E-R-I, cardial, C-A-R-D-I-A-L, effusion, and effusion is E-F-F-U-S-I-O-N. And if you were to go to maybe Wikipedia and put that in, you would get good information about the causes. I'm not doing that right now. So by off the top of my head, I believe that the top common things for this are infection, and we also see it in lupus. You can see it in Lyme's disease. So it could be an autoimmune disease, and it could be an infectious disease. And those are the two top ones. If your relative lives in a place where they don't have very sophisticated medical care or it's very rural, then infection would be high on my list of possibilities.
The only thing I heard from her is that the doctor said she's taking some medicine for rheumatism.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was saying that they have to wait until he's finished, she's finished with the, just a period of using that prescription mm-hmm. for rheumatism, and then see what happens.
Yeah.
She has that kind of collection in around the heart or...
Right. I'd be thinking maybe lupus.
Do you think this is any reason for that?
I think that maybe the two are connected. If she had lupus or some of the other autoimmune diseases, it would look like rheumatism. She would have swollen joints in the hands in particular, painful joints. Sometimes people get a rash, but this is almost like a rash in the bag that holds the heart. And when you get a rash on that kind of tissue, it leaks fluid, and that's how the fluid accumulates in the sac.
I see.
I hope that she'll be. I hope she'll be all right.
This is not a kind of sickness you inherit from your other member of the family, is it?
You can inherit the tendency to the sickness, but we don't. Not everybody who has the genes gets the disease.
I see.
So there's other variables, probably environmental. Maybe triggered by certain infections. We're still trying to sort it all out.
I haven't heard anybody else in the family, her mother, she's my niece that mm-hmm. has this problem.
Well,
her mother or other sister of mine, to have such a problem, my mother or grandmother.
Well, sometimes what happens is that you get... a bad tendency from both sides of the family. So it's when you mix the father and the mother that the child has two bad copies of a gene, And so one bad copy doesn't make you sick, but if you've got two copies, it will make you sick. And there's a lot of diseases like that. Plus, there's many, many things where you inherit a tendency and then something else happens and then something else happens. So it'll come up in one individual, yet other people who have the same genetic risk don't get the disease. So this is all, there's all many, many different possibilities here. It's inheritance of disease is not simple.
That's right. Okay. But no other male member of the family had
right.
That's a problem.
Yeah, I understand.
So this is something new that was,
yeah,
you know, that's the reason
I understand.
You are so anxious to find out what is all about.
Sure. Well, I'm afraid we'll have to stay tuned. I don't think I can help you further with that.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, you
Thank
have a good day.
Thank you very much for your weekly program.
Thank you very much for you, yeah, for listening. We appreciate yeah that. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling
Bye-bye
in, too. Appreciate that. Let's go to Larry in Atlanta. Hello, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Well, Dr. Donna, thank you so much for taking my call. And, of course, I love your show. Fast question. My new sweetheart, who's 57 years young, has condition which I describe as vaginal atrophy. And I would draw this. And I will tell you, I've never been with a woman who's had it before, so I don't know if it's unusual, if it's usual, and if just using a cream would resolve the issue. Any thoughts on that?
Well, sure. yeah, I think anyone who knows me would say that if any thoughts on that's kind of a ridiculous question to ask me, because I always have a thought on it. So vaginal atrophy is just, you can imagine that when a woman goes through puberty, when she starts to develop her breasts and her pubic hair, the lining of the vagina is getting ready to be a sexually active mature person, and it starts developing the mucus glands and, of course, enlarging. Everything that you're going to need to be a sexually active being starts to enlarge at puberty. I'm sure you remember the process yourself.
Yeah.
And in women at postmenopausally, when the estrogen levels drop very rapidly, it's almost like the body says, oh, well, I don't need that stuff anymore, so I'm going to just not spend cellular energy maintaining a structure that I don't need anymore. And if a woman is persistently sexually active, regularly, a lot of times the vagina will hang on beautifully. But if there's if they are widowed or divorced, or there's a period of inactivity, then the system shuts down, and you need to turn the lights back on, literally with a signal, and the signal is estrogen. I believe the safest form of estrogen to use is estriol. It's sometimes called E3. And the reason for that is that, unlike the other two forms of estrogen, estradiol and estrone, estriol does not stimulate the breast estrogen receptor. So we were talking about the weak magnet, strong magnet effect earlier this program. You could think of estriol as being a weak magnet, maybe at the level of soy. So it does, however, work very well for the vaginal estrogen receptor. Mm. So you can have your cake and eat it too by using the cream locally, where you want to get stimulation of the tissues, and it doesn't absorb into the bloodstream. And even if it did, you wouldn't be delivering anything to the breast that you don't want to deliver to the breast. So it's all good. You can use estradiol cream. Unfortunately, there's no generic estradiol cream, so it's like $70 for a little tube of cream,
wow,
whereas you can get twice as much estriol cream made by a compounding pharmacy for about, you know, a third the cost. So that's one. If you take away nothing else from this show, these compounding pharmacies, particularly when we're talking about a cream. Because I don't so much worry about a cream getting contaminated with some bacteria. You can make the argument that the large manufacturers have better hygiene, or they certainly have more inspections. There's been a huge clampdown in California on compounding pharmacies, and so they have very, very, very high standards and lots of inspections. So I don't really worry about things coming out of California. But a few years ago, we had a horrible event occur with compounding pharmacies where some bad steroids that were contaminated with fungus, and these were steroids intended to be injected into the spinal columns of people. So doctors unsuspectingly were injecting fungus into people's brains.
Wow.
Now, that's pretty high stakes. So I will say that compounding pharmacy, that particular compounding pharmacy is obviously out of business, but they really kind of were a discredit to the entire concept and made everybody a little bit gun-shy. So we're still recovering from that one.
Dr. Don, fast question. I wonder, should she see her gynecologist about this first? And is estriol something you get over the counter, or do you need a prescription for it?
You need a prescription for it. It does have to. It isn't available over the counter, and nor should it be, because you could get into trouble with any kind of over-the-counter hormone. All right. So I would. She will need to see her doctor.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the call, Larry. We've got to go now, but keep listening.
I will. Bye, dear.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Don saying it's been a lovely day. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. So long, and stay healthy.